This is the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks on KQV with expert advice from CPA, attorney, and retirement and estate planning expert Jim Lang, best-selling author of Retire Secure and The Roth Revolution, Pay Taxes Once, Then Never Again. Now on air and worldwide, paytaxeslater.com. Now get ready to talk smart money.
And welcome to the Lang Money Hour. I'm Dan Weinberg, along with CPA and attorney Jim Lang. Active versus passive investing. It's been a hot topic in recent years. Well, tonight we welcome a guest who believes there really should be no debate at all. Noted author and nationally recognized investment expert Larry Swedrow has spent years using scientific analysis to show that passive investing through index funds and other passively managed funds is the best path to prosperity. Larry's director of research for Buckingham Asset Management and the BAM Alliance. He's authored 15 books. His latest is The Incredible Shrinking Alpha, and he's made numerous appearances on TV sharing his ideas with viewers of NBC, CNBC, CNN, and Bloomberg Personal Finance. Now, tonight you're going to learn what alpha is, whether active money managers are likely to succeed in today's environment, and whether those using a passive investment strategy should get some help or go it alone. We also welcome your specific questions for these two experts who have a wealth of knowledge to share with you, so please give us a call at 412-333-9385. That's 412-333-9385. Now let's say good evening to Jim Lang and Larry Swedrow.
Welcome, Larry.
Thanks for having me, Jim. Pleasure to be back.
And congratulations on a great book. I've always liked your books, but Incredible Shrinking Alpha is terrific. Now, I have kind of an early version. Is this available on Amazon right now?
Yes, it is. It has been since January.
Okay. So, again, The Incredible Shrinking Alpha, just a great book by Larry Swedrow, S-W-E-D-R-O-E, and it is particularly appropriate for investors who are trying to get the most out of what they have with the highest degree of safety. So the name of your book is The Incredible Shrinking Alpha. Can we start out with a simple question and just say, what is alpha?
Sure, it's an important question because Wall Street wants to mislead you often. So alpha we define as returns above the appropriate risk-adjusted benchmark. So a simple example that I'm sure all your listeners will follow is if you invest in, say, junk bonds, and they're clearly much riskier, and you're in a higher rate of return than I do if I invest in treasury bonds, and you claim alpha, that's either lying or, at the worst, at the best interpretation, would be misleading. Now, if your portfolio of junk bonds that you selected outperformed a junk bond index, then you might be able to claim that that's alpha because you outperformed an appropriate benchmark. So if you're investing in stocks and, Jim, you invest in emerging markets and I invest in U.S. large cap stocks, you're taking more risk. And if you outperform, that's not alpha. But if you outperformed an emerging markets index, that would be alpha. And you can look at this thing in the right way, which is if you invest in small cap stocks, then you benchmark it against a small cap index, against value stocks, against the value index, etc.
All right, well, let's take the most well-known index, which is probably the S&P 500, and a lot of times people make that analogous to the Vanguard S&P 500. What would be the equivalent of, say, outperforming, or I think you're going to try to make the case saying that it's very difficult for a comparable fund to, or a comparable, even using active money management, to outperform the S&P, particularly after fees?
Well, it's actually been very easy to outperform the S&P 500 over long periods anyway. And all you had to do was invest in small cap stocks or value stocks. Small cap stocks have outperformed the S&P by about 2% a year. Large value stocks also by about 2% a year. And small value stocks by more like 4% a year, just rounding there. So if you're comparing yourself to the S&P 500, that's only being appropriate if you invest in stocks that are similar to those in the S&P 500, which are basically what are more large cap and more growth-oriented types of portfolios, the stocks that are in the S&P 500. So if I'm running a fund and I'm an active manager and I'm deciding that these 250 stocks within the S&P 500 are going to outperform the other 250, so I'm just going to buy the top 250 winners and exclude the 250 that I think will underperform, and I actually outperform, that is truly alpha. But if I invest in small cap stocks or emerging market stocks and outperform, that's not alpha.
Okay. I just, by the way, you just said something that was that I think is of should be of tremendous interest of to viewers. And let me make sure I understand that. If you were in small caps, whether it's a small cap index, and let's even assume a small cap index, although it could be a collection of small companies. When I say small companies, I don't mean mom-and-pop grocery stores, but maybe like $1 billion as opposed to $100 billion. You're saying that you could expect a 4% greater return than the S&P 500?
No, sorry. So
I thought it was about two. I thought it was about 2.5, right?
Yeah. So here's the long-term data. If you go back to 1926, basically the market and the S&P, meaning the market being all stocks and the S&P 500 have had very similar returns, partly because the S&P dominates the total market. Currently, it's about 80% or so of the total market. So 500 of the roughly 3,500 stocks make up 80% or more of the total value. If you bought the smallest stocks, and you might think of them, roughly speaking, as the smallest 10% of all stocks on the market, they've actually returned about 10%. About 12%. Large value stocks have also returned about 12%, and small value stocks closer to 14. Again, I'm just rounding here.
Okay, but by the way, I think that this is critical information, because I would say that 9 out of 10 people, maybe even more, they come into my office, and if I like them and they like me, we actually analyze their portfolio. And virtually all of them would be significantly underweighted in small cap, in emerging markets, and in value. And if I understand what you're saying right, if they had a heavier emphasis on value, on small, and on emerging markets, at least given historical returns, that they would likely over a long period of time have a greater return. And if I also understand you right, you're saying, hey, that's not alpha, that's just a greater return because they're investing in different asset classes.
Well, let me take it just a step further. I think people have to consider not just return but risk. There's a reason small and value companies, and especially small value companies, have historically had over the long term higher returns. That's the general view. A traditional financial theory says it's because they're riskier. So just as one measure of risk would be volatility, which we can look at as the standard deviation using a technical term. But the market or the S&P, the volatility has been up roughly 18 to 20% a year. For small cap stocks in general and for large value stocks, it's kind of high 20s, 28% or so. So you got a higher return, but more volatility, higher highs and lower lows. Small value stocks, which have had the greatest performance, that higher return is not a free lunch. The volatility was even higher at about 35% a year. And emerging markets, I think we can recognize, are generally more volatile, risky. They have outperformed the S&P by quite a bit, but it's compensation for taking extra risk. Now, the one thing we do know from the historical evidence is that these asset classes, as we call them, don't have perfect correlation. They don't tend to go up and down and by the same amounts at the same time. And so even though you're adding, by diversifying into these different asset classes, done properly, the evidence is that you've actually gotten higher returns with about the same amount of portfolio risk. So that's where the advantage comes in. If you diversify across these asset classes, on an individual basis, the stocks and the asset classes are higher, but the right way to look at it is in an entire portfolio context, and you've had about the same volatility but higher returns depending on how much you, the word I use is tilted to, small and value and emerging markets. The more you tilt, the more you expose yourself to those factors, the higher the return.
Now, Larry, I think of you as, I know you're not really an academic, but I think of you as a true research, academic-based writer and commentator. Is the information that you're giving us, is this backed up with academic studies, and is this something that our readers can rely on, or are you just one more guy spouting some opinions off the top of your head?
Well, the good news here is nothing that is said in my books or in any of my blogs, my writings on ETF.com or mutualfund.com or advice I give to our clients, none of it is based upon my opinions. It's all based upon what we like to refer to as the science of investing or evidence-based investing, evidence from peer-reviewed academic journals, and everything written in my book, I even cite the studies for people so they can go read them if they like. They point to this simple fact, Jim, and I think this is where you are leading. If you're an active investor, and by that I mean you're trying to pick individual stocks, not just you're going to say I'm going to invest in small stocks, but I know which of the 50 best small stocks to buy, and I know when small stocks are going to do poorly, and I'll get out of them and move into large stocks, and I can time the market. So that's the other option for active managers, either stock selection or market timing, neither of which either of us engage in our recommendations. There's certainly a chance that you're going to outperform the market. And when I first wrote my book in 1998, there was about 20% of all active managers on a pre-tax basis were outperforming their appropriate benchmarks. After taxes, the number was probably about 10%. Now, today, for the reasons I talk about in my book, there are four big themes, it's become much harder, and even pre-tax, the odds of outperforming on an appropriate risk-adjusted basis have dropped down to 2%. Now, I don't know about you, but I might put a dollar on a lottery ticket with those kind of odds, but I'm not taking my retirement account to the Merrill Lynch or Goldman Sachs or other Jim Cramer's office with 50-to-1 odds even pre-tax and maybe 100-to-1 on an after-tax basis. I want to invest in funds that are low-cost, well-diversified, and passively managed based on this academic research that we've talked about.
Now, hold on, Larry. You're knocking Jim Cramer. Did you know if you followed all of Jim Cramer's advice, you would have $1 million today if you started with $2 million?
Right, that's exactly. Actually, I've written
now, please,
a story.
All right, now, I'm kidding. Jim Cramer's office, please don't sue me.
But I have written several pieces on Jim Cramer, who I think is a very smart guy, but I wouldn't follow any of his advice. And there are actually two studies. Again, I only write about what you can find in peer-reviewed journals and other academic papers. There were two studies on Jim Cramer's recommendations, and what they found is this. This is exactly what an academic would expect. After Cramer makes his recommendations, which appear on his show at night, they tracked his recommendations. The first move in the morning was, of course, individuals thinking that Cramer knows something would run in and buy, and then the professional investors, the mutual funds, hedge funds, and others, would come in and short the stocks, driving the price right back down. By within 3 days, the price ended up exactly back where it started from, and the people who bought lost, and the professionals who shorted won. That's what happened.
Well, you talk about the tougher competition today and the greater amount of information that is available that gives professional investors an edge over private investors. Could you tell us a little bit more about why before 10% of the active money managers were beating the indexes, and now, I mean, to pick an active money manager, and assuming that, that what you're saying is right, and by the way, I heard 97%, so we're within a percent, are beating the market, that sounds pretty tough. Why is it so tough? You know, let's say I'm a, you know, I have an MBA from Harvard, and I have a team of MBAs, and we have super fast computers, and we all subscribe to the most expensive financial news, and we're sitting there and we're calling up different managers of different companies trying to do our research. Why wouldn't the more than 2% of them outperform an index?
Well, the reason is fairly simple, is you have to understand the nature of the game and the competition. So I think it's important for your listeners to understand. Let's go back to 1945, and Warren Buffett is trying to pick stocks and identify winners. Who is his competition? At the time, 90% of all stocks were owned directly by people like you and me, individual investors. Now, if I ask you this question or your listeners this question, Jim, let's see what the answer is. So, Jim, who do you think is our tougher competitors? Who knows more about the market and stocks? Is it individual investors or the professionals like mutual funds, hedge funds, pension plans, you know, endowments, et cetera, hire top professionals to run money? Who would you rather compete against? Individuals who watch Jim Cramer on TV or the equivalent, or these professionals who have MBAs in finance, et cetera, who study this, do it full time. Who's the tougher competition?
Well, of course, I'd rather bet on people who are studied and have knowledge and spend their lives
exactly.
doing this.
Exactly. So 60, 70 years ago, Warren Buffett was 90% of the time he was trading against people like you and me. And, you know, I don't know about you, when I look in the mirror, I don't see Warren Buffett. I don't want to try to compete against him. He's likely to win. Even 50 years ago, there were less than 100 mutual funds, and there was only a handful of hedge funds. Today, less than 20% of all stocks are owned by individuals. 90% or more of the trading is done by institutions, hedge funds, etc., mutual funds, other equivalents of Warren Buffett. So the game is being played with Warren Buffett 90% of the time competing against somebody who is pretty skillful, much harder for him. And even Buffett tells you, there's no way I can get the kind of returns I used to get, and that's one of the reasons. When Goldman Sachs is trading today, 90% of the time it's Morgan Stanley on the other end of the trade. Exactly who is the victim? Where's the sucker at the poker table there that's being exploited? The problem is the competition has gotten tougher. Not only are they institutions, but 30, 40 years ago, the average professional money manager at a mutual fund probably had a liberal arts degree and spent some time studying, you know, as an apprentice and worked his way up. Maybe he had a business degree. There weren't even masters of finance. I got one of the first masters of finance degrees in the late 60s. Finance wasn't even a profession until then. Today, almost everybody who's running money at a hedge fund or a mutual fund is not only an MBA in finance or a PhD in finance, they're literally today rocket scientists. I know you're a big believer like we are. We invest heavily with Dimensional Fund Advisors, a mutual fund family with about $400 billion of assets. Their two chief co-investment officers are both PhD physicists or scientists with advanced degrees in math and science. The people who run hedge funds have similar degrees. Anyone who's running money has a PhD or MBA in finance. The competition's much tougher. It's harder to out-compete these guys. So here's the analogy I think that's very helpful for people. Who would you say is the best tennis player in the world today, Jim?
Well, that would be...
Maybe Novak Djokovic.
Djokovic was the first... Maybe Nadal.
Yeah, so let's say Novak Djokovic, he's playing in the first round of a tournament, let's say something like the U.S. Open. How many times does he lose a first-round match because it's against somebody who's not even ranked probably in the top 100 in the world?
Certainly less than 5%, maybe 1% or 2%.
Less than 1%. I don't even think he's lost a first-round match in years, but the competition there is much easier. Think of that as Warren Buffett competing against you and me 70 years ago. As Djokovic wins each round and he advances through, the competition is getting harder. And in his first round match, he probably wins 6-0, 6-1 or something like that. They rarely last more than an hour or so. By the time he gets to the finals, he's playing Federer or Andy Murray or Rafa Nadal, and it's a four or five hour marathon, five sets, tiebreakers. It's very hard to tell who's really better, right? The competition is much more difficult. So what the analogy is, when Buffett and professional investors, even 20 years ago, when they had a 20% pre-tax chance of outperforming, it was because there was competition that was easier. That's the early rounds of the competition. Like Buffett, say, 70 years ago, when 90% of the money was individuals competing. Today, it's these professional investors, these hedge funds and mutual funds, etc. They're competing at the U.S. Open in the finals. It's Djokovic against Federer, and maybe he wins, but boy, the ability to outperform, it's very hard to tell, and that's why you're seeing it's so much harder. There's a much smaller pool of victims that you can exploit, and the remaining competition is becoming more and more skilled, making it harder for you to outperform.
If you're sitting at a poker table and you can't spot the sucker, it's probably you. We are here with Larry Swedrow, who is the author of a new book called Incredible Shrinking Alpha, which I highly recommend, particularly for people who are, let's say, trying to figure out whether they should pursue an active versus a passive strategy. Larry, in your book, one of my favorite analogies, because you have a very good way of making a complex issue easily understood, is you talk about finding a $20 bill on the ground. Can you tell us why that has anything to do with being an active versus a passive manager?
Yeah, so there's a standard joke in the academic community that goes like this. There's two economists walking down the street, and one of them stops and says, look, there's a $20 bill on the floor, and the other says, that can't be, the market's too efficient, there can't be a $20 bill there. If there was, someone would have picked it up already. So that's the joke. The real analogy to this, the way economists would think about it is, yeah, it's certainly possible that you can find $20 bills sitting on the floor, if you will, meaning that there's a stock that you could identify that is mispriced. But the odds of your finding it are very low, and you could spend years trying to find one, and after all of the expenses of the effort, you're likely to end up losing because there aren't many of them around. Just think about how many people would spend their lives at the beach trying to find, with those metal detectors, those equivalent of $20 bills, right? And they don't find them. That's really the right way to think about this problem. There may be $20 bills, but it's not a good idea to spend your life trying to find them because there aren't many of them around.
Well, okay, so let's say that somebody says, okay, hey, gee, only 2% of the active money managers outperform the indexes. Well, in that case, why don't I just get an appropriate percentage of stocks and bonds, buy Vanguard indexes, which is probably the least expensive and certainly a quality index fund, and go home. Is that a reasonable strategy, or should we talk about the premiums that you had mentioned earlier in terms of equity premium and small cap premium and value premium, and then a few that we haven't talked about. What should an investor be thinking about when they are putting together a portfolio? Let's even assuming that they buy the argument that it's very difficult to beat the market. So then what should they be doing and thinking about in terms of premiums?
Right. Well, the first thing I want to emphasize the point you're making, your choice of words is exactly right. Neither of us would ever say that it's impossible to beat the market. It's just that the odds of doing so are so poor that you shouldn't try. So we agree, we state it's certainly possible. If you try to beat the market, it's possible you will outperform.
Well, apparently 2% of the money managers are, is that right?
Yeah, and 2% pre-tax, right? Mm-hmm. The problem is neither you nor I nor anyone else has figured out a way to identify those few ahead of time. That's really the problem. So that's why it's a loser's game there. If we could identify those 2%, even though it was 2%, it would be a different story. But no one has figured that out yet. So that's the first thing.
Including Charlie Ellis, who's been on the show, who's the author of a book called The Loser's Game, which is looking for those 2%.
Exactly. And Charles Ellis, if your listeners aren't familiar with his books, I would urge them to read them. He inspired a lot of my writing. So that's the first thing. Second thing, many people confuse indexing, and I think this may be what you were leading to, with the simple use or exclusive use of an S&P 500 index fund. So you could own Vanguard funds and buy small caps and value stocks and emerging market stocks, etc. That's not exclusive. The question is, can you do it yourself? Well, my own estimate of the people who could actually do it themselves, even though the winning strategy is actually pretty simple. You and I know that the right strategy is simply to build a globally diversified portfolio and then have the discipline to stay the course. It isn't easy. First, you have to know to figure out what the right asset allocation for you is. Two, you have to choose the best vehicles. Vanguard funds are good. You and I both use dimensional fund advisors funds, for example. We think they're superior vehicles, and they have historically outperformed similar Vanguard funds, so you can do a bit better. And then you've got all the issues of tax management. You've got all of the issues of having the disciplines, being able to stay the course, rebalance, tax manage. And also, as you well know, Jim, as you're an expert in this area, you have to be able to integrate a well-thought-out investment plan into an overall estate tax and risk management plan, meaning insurance of all kinds. Otherwise, the whole plan could blow up for reasons that have nothing to do with investing, right?
Yeah, it is. In fact, even Jack Bogle, who's been on the show, said that there is a value to having a financial advisor, which actually shocked me because I think of him, by the way, an American hero, don't get me wrong.
But I agree.
But I don't think of him as the kind of guy who is a big fan of paying any kind of fee to anybody.
Right. I think that in my book, Think, Act, and Invest Like Warren Buffett, I give people a series of questions to answer to see if they can do it themselves. Do they have the discipline, the knowledge, et cetera, to do it? My own estimate, and Bill Bernstein, another author, and I'd recommend his books to all of your listeners, he agrees with my estimate. And it's probably less than 5% of people truly have the ability to do it themselves, the interest, the discipline, even if they have the knowledge.
And by the way, that doesn't take into consideration, and this might sound a little bit self-serving, but in our company, we have a unique arrangement where our company, and our CPAs, we run the numbers, we tell people what the ideal Roth IRA conversion strategy,
right,
the ideal Social Security strategy, how much money they can spend. Then the money manager actually uses DFA or Dimensional Fund Advisor funds. Mm-hmm. doing with the appropriate asset allocation, and also doing what he calls the bucket analysis, meaning you wouldn't have one portfolio, you would have multiple ones based on different time needs. But what I'd like to get back to, because you mentioned it briefly, is when you're talking about the equity premium and the small cap premium and the value premium, there's actually other premiums in the market also that you identify in your book. And by the way, we don't have all that much time, so I want to just mention, in case anybody has just tuned in, we are here with Larry Swedrow, who is the author of what I think, well, actually about 15 books, but his latest one I think is just terrific, and it's a great resource for people who are thinking about, should I invest with an active money manager or a passive or index type approach. And the name of the book is Incredible Shrinking Alpha by Larry Swedrow, Swedroe, which is available at Amazon.com. But anyway, Larry, if you could talk a little bit more about either the existing premiums that we already mentioned, or even some of the ones that we didn't.
Right. So the academic literature has been advancing over time. The first premium, if you will, that was discovered was the market premium, or beta, if you will, in academic terms. Then the value and size premiums were reported on. And after that, there's been a couple of others. One of them is called momentum. That means there's a tendency for not only stocks, but bonds and commodities and currencies that have done well in the recent past to continue to do well in the near future before they mean revert. So a stock that has outperformed in the last year is likely to continue to outperform for about another, on average, 5 to 6 months. Same thing is true of currencies, etc. So that's one premium, and that's been persistent around the world and across asset classes, as I mentioned. So that's one thing. Another is more recent research at what's called the profitability premium. Companies that have been more profitable, have higher gross margins, have tended to outperform companies that are less profitable. By the way, that's one of the things Warren Buffett has been telling people to buy, not only buy stocks that are low price, but tended to be more profitable companies. So, in other words, the scientists have finally discovered, if you will, the secret sauce that Warren Buffett knew before everybody else. And now they've actually found, and I write about it in my book, if you constructed an index of stocks that have these characteristics that Buffett has told you to buy over the last basically 50 years, so I give him all the credit. He discovered it before the academics. Basically, Buffett's alpha disappears, even though he's outperformed the S&P 500, say by 5% or whatever the number is now per year. If you properly risk adjust for account for these factors, Buffett's alpha literally disappears. So we now can have clients, your clients, through DFA are investing basically the way Warren Buffett has been telling people to invest for the last 50 years, and doing so globally, by the way.
All right. By the way, that's really a telling thought. That is that Warren Buffett, and again, all the credit in the world to him, because he came up with these premiums ahead of time, actually was not as great a stock picker as we might think, because he was very astute in recognizing and utilizing, let's say, the small cap premium, the value premium, which I think a lot of people know about. The equity premium, of course, is buying stocks instead of bonds. And now we're introducing two others that that perhaps Warren Buffett has been using without necessarily making it clear he was using it, but that you're calling the profitability premium and the momentum premium. And if I understand you right, what you're saying is, if you know that these premiums exist and you go backwards and you're, let's say, buying based on the knowledge of these premiums, that Warren Buffett didn't outperform or pick stocks that were so outrageously better than, let's say, a set of index funds that would have taken these premiums into account. Is that yeah. fair?
Yeah, I think that, just to be clear, so Warren Buffett discovered that you should buy these stocks ahead of, before the academics. But what we now know is if you bought an index of all of the stocks that had these characteristics, you did as well as Buffett. So what that means is that Buffett's skill was really two things. He added value in two ways. First, he was able to discover these characteristics before anybody else, and he also had the discipline to stay the course. But if you bought an index of all of these stocks, you would have done just as well. Of course, you also would have had to have the same discipline. So here's an example of that. Buffett was not a player in small cap stocks, but he was a player in value stocks. So if you bought companies, keeping it simple, with low price to earnings ratios, he bought more profitable companies, but he also focused on companies that now academics use this term quality, which is a broader definition. For your readers who are interested, there's a paper called Buffett's Alpha, which is really an excellent piece describing this. But Buffett looked at companies that also had strong balance sheets, so they didn't have a lot of debt. They had persistent and low volatility of earnings, for example, and they had low operating and financial leverage. So if you just rank stocks and say bought the top 30% of companies and bought all of them, where Buffett bought only 10 that he thought would have been the best, your entire list of the 30% would have done as well as Buffett's 10 that he actually bought. So his skill was identifying the characteristics before the academics did, not an individual stock selection and staying the course. Let me just add this point, Jim. What academics often do to uncover these things is they look at the performance of the great money managers and try to, let's use the word, reverse engineer. Look for the types of characteristics of stocks that they're buying and then see if they can identify those characteristics and then systematize it.
All right, and just one last thought before the break. I believe that there is a fine financial researcher and analyst who's written a book that has something to do with Invest Like Warren Buffett. Do you know who that would be and where they could get that book?
This one right here,
called, you mean? It's called Think, Act, and Invest Like Warren Buffett, and I wrote it a few years ago, and you, of course, can get it on Amazon. And I talk about what really some key attributes that can help you get the kinds of returns Buffett has earned.
Okay, so we have two fine books by Larry Swedrow. Actually, there's 15 of them, but two that we'll mention. One, The Incredible Shrinking Alpha, which is the new one, and that's Swedroe. And then Think and Invest Like Warren Buffett?
Think,
Act, and Invest Like Warren Buffett. We are here with Larry Swedrow, who is the author of 15 books, but the most recent and the one that I think is just incredible, interestingly enough, is called The Incredible Shrinking Alpha. And he is talking about how tough it is to beat the market, and I think does a pretty convincing case of saying that really only about 2% of the active money managers are beating the market, and that's assuming that these are really smart guys with MBAs, et cetera, and for the individual investor to beat the market is even tougher. Is that fair, Larry?
Yeah, that 2%, by the way, is confirmed in two studies, and by the way, I'll repeat what I mentioned earlier. That 2% is before taxes, not after taxes. So if you've got your money in an IRA account, you've got a 2% chance. Many people are holding their equities. They don't have enough room in their IRA accounts where they should be holding their bond portfolios. And if they're holding equities in a taxable account, then if you're an active manager, the odds of winning go way down, because for active managers, taxes are often the greatest expense. So the odds are probably less than 1%. So that's 1 in 100 odds. I don't know about you, Jim, but I don't like those kind of odds playing with my retirement account.
Again, Charlie Ellis calls that the loser's game. So let me ask you this. Let's say that Maybe I'll ask two questions before we end the show. But the first one, and I want to be fair because, of course, I'm trying to get some business for my own company with the appropriate clients, because I'm at the agent stage where I don't need pains in the you-know-what. and I actually mean that. We have a $500,000 minimum, and you have to become a client, you probably have to go through about two meetings with me, probably two meetings with the money manager, but we do and have a $500,000 minimum, but we do have a 99% retainage rate. So we're careful about who we take, but then once we take them, it usually works out pretty well. But I want to be fair because I know that there's a lot of listeners here who are, let's say, do-it-yourselfers and people who are naturally inclined to prefer Vanguard funds, although don't feel limited to Vanguard funds. But for the pure do-it-yourselfer, the person who says, hey, I don't want to pay any money manager a nickel, I want to keep my costs down, what kind of advice would you have for the do-it-yourselfer listener?
Well, I would first of all tell them to read a few of my books on how to build a prudent strategy. I've written a book called The Only Guide You'll Ever Need for the Right Financial Plan, as that would be helpful for them. So you want to make sure, one, you have a plan, you write it down, it identifies what I call your unique ability, willingness, and need to take risk. Getting that asset allocation, as you know, right is so critical, and it changes over time as you age and life events happen. You might inherit money and you have more ability to take risk, but certainly less need to take it. You may have a divorce, a loss of a job. That's going to lessen your ability to take risk, and you probably should have then less equity allocation. All these issues. So you have to be able to identify that. Once you do that, then what you want to do is make the decision on how much U.S. stocks and international stocks. I recommend a starting point of 50% U.S. and 50% international, because that's how the market is pretty much. But there's nothing wrong with 60% U.S. and 40% international, or whatever you think is appropriate, as long as you stick with whatever allocation you choose and are diversified. And then you have to choose how much large and small and value, et cetera, and how much emerging markets, all those things. You can use certainly Vanguard's funds, but there are also other alternatives. There are ETFs that might even be cheaper and maybe more appropriate. You have to know how to make those decisions. But even if you chose a simple two-fund with stocks portfolio, Vanguard's U.S. Total Stock Market Fund and a Vanguard Total International Fund, and then bought maybe a safe intermediate treasury or investment-grade bond fund for your bonds, if you do that and also have the discipline to stay the course, I'm confident that you'll outperform 80 to 90% of the professional money managers, even though you're not choosing the optimal type of strategy which could be improved on. So that's the key. Keep it simple. Make sure you understand the strategy. Stay the course. That's Buffett's really key to success. He never panicked when others were panicking. In fact, he would be buying, which is exactly, Jim, what you recommend to your clients, not because you're trying to time the market, because you tell them to buy when they need to rebalance, which means after equities have done poorly, they have to buy to get back to their target.
It's interesting that you say that 50-50 is okay in terms of international and U.S., or even 60-40, but whatever you choose, and I would imagine you would say the same thing with stocks and bonds in general, whatever you choose to stick with it. And I remember Jonathan Clemens saying the exact right same thing, saying that it's not as important which allocation you go in with as the fact that you stick with the allocation that you decide on.
Yeah, one of my favorite expressions is there's no one right portfolio. The right portfolio for you is the one that will most likely enable you to stay the course. So even though I think having about, say, 15% of your equities in emerging markets is about the right mix, that's about where they are as a global market capitalization, if you will panic and sell, because the last few years emerging markets have done poorly and you're reading about China and Brazil doing poorly, then you should have zero and you'd be better off, because you will panic and sell, of course, at the wrong time, and you're worse off. So whatever is most likely to enable you to stay the course is what you should stick with.
All right, and we only have about 1 minute left, and I hate to shortchange the advice for an investor that may have been burned by in the past but doesn't want to manage their own money. What are some of the options or ways that a not do-it-yourselfer could move forward?
Well, in my book, Think, Act, and Invest Like Buffett, there's a short chapter on how to choose an advisor, but I'll give people a few simple rules. One, it must be someone who is prepared to put in writing that they are a fiduciary, which means they're giving advice solely in your interest.
I agree.
Number two, they have to be able to show you that they're investing in exactly the same vehicles that they're recommending to you. Of course, they may have a different asset allocation because they're a different person. If they're not prepared to show you to that, run. Number three, they should be prepared to show you that their recommendations are based upon not their opinions, but on academic research, and share that with you. And the fourth thing, I think, is exactly what you talk to your clients about. You don't want to work with a money manager. You want to work with a wealth advisor, someone who integrates estate planning, insurance, and all these other things, because even the best investment plan, a perfect one, can blow up for reasons that have nothing to do with investing. You die early and you don't have enough life insurance. You don't have an umbrella policy, and your teenage son, you know, gets in a car accident, maims, or worse, kills somebody. You have an attorney who writes up a good estate documents, but the trusts never get funded. I'm sure you've seen plenty of those things.
We sure have. Again, thank you, Larry Swedrow, author of Incredible Shrinking Alpha. Again, Swedroe, author of a great book that I highly recommend, The Incredible Shrinking Alpha.
Thanks for listening to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks. Check out the show archives and listen on demand anytime at paytaxeslater.com.